Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And as usual, we begin the Triangle Business Journal with a look at the biz page. Under the heading of New Concept comes the article, Former Spanky's Location is Serving Up Fried Chicken. Look for fried chicken and other southern favorites on the menu at the Chapel Hill Restaurant Group opens Lula's in the old Spanky's location. Lula's menu is set to include fried chicken, pork chops, short ribs, and fresh vegetables. The restaurant's expected to open soon. It's centered around the fried chicken. We wanted something funky and fun that's also very inexpensive, says Greg Overbeck of the Chapel Hill Restaurant Group. Chef William Dovray, the previous chef and owner of Finn's in Raleigh, is the mastermind behind Lula's menu. Lula was his great-grandmother, Overbeck says. Spanky's, inspired by restaurants in the Georgetown district of Washington, D.C., opened in 1977, but business eventually slowed, especially when the drinking age was raised to 21, and CHRG decided to change the concept. And under the heading of Still Waiting, the article, The Train Has Not Arrived at Union Station Just Yet. The train is not quite ready to leave the station in downtown Raleigh, more than a month after a ribbon-cutting ceremony marked the completion of Union Station, the city's new multimodal transportation center. City officials initially estimated the station would open for train service 30 to 45 days after the event, but that date has been pushed back. Raleigh Transit Administrator David Eatman now says the target opening date is June 27. Still, Amtrak has already launched one additional round-trip train to Charlotte, which started June 4th at the old station on West Cabarra Street. The train is on the Piedmont line and pushes its total daily round trips to 4. The additional service means a train will depart at 3 p.m. and arrive at Charlotte at 6:10 p.m. every day of the week. And under the heading of Connected comes the article, Duke Among First to Get Cool App. Proving that it never hurts to have a CEO on your board of trustees, Apple has announced that Duke University will be one of the first 6 schools to integrate student ID cards to the Apple Wallet app, which will be available this fall. The integration will allow Apple Watches and iPhones to replace student ID cards and streamline student accessibility on campus. The update allows students entrance to campus libraries, dorms, and events, as well as make purchases from campus shops, bookstores, laundry, and vending machines, and even register class attendance. Apple CEO Tim Cook got his MBA at Duke and is on the school's board of trustees. By the way, one of the schools in the initial launch is the University of Alabama, which has to annoy Auburn University, Cook's alma mater. And under the heading of Great Idea, the article, Golf Event in Cary Raises Thousands for Soldiers. A local golf tournament to support North Carolina soldiers continues to have a long run and go a long way to supporting the troops. Aaron Singh, the founder and organizer of the EDM4 U.S. Troops Tournament at Prestonwood Country Club, says the goal is to give money directly to North Carolina soldiers. It basically started 7 years ago, Singh says. The whole concept was to help out the local North Carolina troops who've been hurt post 9/11. The event, held June 4, started out years ago with around 80 golfers and has now swelled to 250. That's why the tournament has become very popular, Singh says. They see where the money is going. The money raised is distributed in 3 ways. Some proceeds go to Enable America, which helps wounded veterans, and to the Soldiers and Airmen Assistance Fund, which supports North Carolina National Guard troops facing a financial crisis. Around 80% of the money goes directly to soldiers who are nominated to receive the honor. This year, 4 soldiers received checks of approximately $10,000 each. These soldiers appreciate it, Singh says. They don't know us at all. When they find out someone wants to give them a check, they're blown away. And under the heading, Start Your Engines, the article is Earnhardt Concept, now serving in RDU Terminal 2. Whiskey River is officially open at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Technically, it had already been open for several days when Dale Earnhardt Jr. flew in for a visit June 4th. Earnhardt, who retired from racing after the 2017 season, started the restaurant in Charlotte and has recently been introducing the brand at airports. At RDU, you'll find it at Terminal 2. And completing the biz page for this week, under the heading of Interesting Buyer, the article is Why the Beach is Buzzing About the Pricey Beaufort Home. One of the most expensive sales in Carteret County in a while is the buzz at the beach, thanks to a mysterious buyer. A house just outside the center of Beaufort, and one with spectacular views of the water, sold this month for $2.35 million, according to two local realtors. That would make it one of the highest sales in recent memory in that coastal community. The home at 2684 Lennoxville Road was purchased by a Raleigh LLC named Gonzi e Libri. Gonzi e Libri, which is Italian for hooks and books, was formed April 9th. According to the North Carolina Secretary of State's website, the LLC's mailing office and principal office are the San Francisco home of Arnold and Porter, a large international law firm. All this, of course, has people in Beaufort wondering, who's going to be enjoying a sumptuous home with long porches and water views in all directions? The Arnold and Porter attorney, who's the point person for Gonzi e Libri LLC, did not return a call for comment. Arnold and Porter has a massive client list, but has done work for Amazon and Apple. Who knows? Maybe Jeff Bezos or Tim Cook will soon be eating oysters at the Dock House. Now we turn to the Banking Tech Transportation page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And the first article under the heading of Weighing Change is KS Bancorp Shareholders Vote on Shift to Delaware. KS Bancorp shareholders have approved a proposal that could see the Smithfield Bank incorporating in Delaware. That's according to KS Bancorp CEO Harold Keene, speaking after the shareholder meeting last month. But he cautions that the board hasn't taken any action on it. Without action, the bank continues to operate as a North Carolina entity. The bank, in an April letter to shareholders, had proposed the shift as a way to stave off acquisition interest. By converting to a Delaware corporation, the firm could take advantage of the certainty provided by extensive Delaware case law, including greater ability to resist hostile corporate takeovers, a proxy stated. It was trying to protect its poison pill provision, enacted as a reaction to First Citizens, which had been scooping up shares of the bank. First Citizens is selling its stake to KS as part of a lawsuit settlement. And under the heading of Planned Expansion comes the article, Lenovo Sees Growth in RTP. Lenovo's Research Triangle Park operation is growing, both in terms of revenue and visibility, says Kirk Scoggin, the executive vice president over the firm's data center group. Speaking days after the company reported 44% growth in its RTP-based data center business, the largest revenue growth reported since the acquisition of IBM's RTP-based low-end server business in 2014, Scoggin says his operation is on an upswing. I don't think this was an accident, he says, of the earnings report. Scoggin, when hired 18 months ago, had a 400-day transformation plan. The first 100 days would be a review of operations. Next up would be implementing the fixes, followed by 100 days to make sure fixes took hold. And the last 100 days would be making those same changes in China. Because it was our largest PC and server geography, we didn't want to make changes there until we knew it was working in the rest of the world. And under the heading of Federal Ruling comes the article, Rodanthe Bridge Project to Move Forward. A federal judge in Raleigh has ruled against a group of Outer Bank property owners who had helped to stop the Rodanthe Bridge Project in its track. Judge Louise Flanagan, in a 46-page summary judgment June 4th, ruled against the coalition known as Save Our Sound OBX, which had sued to prevent the North Carolina Department of Transportation from building the 2.4-mile, $145 million bridge. The ruling means NCDOT can move forward on the project. We believe it will be later this month or in July, said NCDOT spokesman Steve Abbott of the start date. Division staff have to talk to the contractor on timeline specifics. Property owners had alleged in their lawsuit that plans for the bridge didn't consider the full environmental ramifications. But in the summary judgment filing, Flanagan sides with NCDOT, contending that consideration was given to both the bridge's environmental impact and its encroachment on recreational activities, including kiteboarding. The homeowners' challenges fail from the outset because they don't consider the reasons the state decided that beach nourishment alone was inadequate, the ruling claims. By just nourishing the shore, a process where sand is replaced to counter erosion, the stretch would still be subject to breaching and overwash, resulting in road closures, the filing notes. Even among the kiteboarding community, there were vocal residents on both sides of the issue. Even as property owners were saying they feared the bridge would keep kiteboarding renters away during the busy tourism season, some were tired of being stranded on Rodanthian storm-caused washouts. NCDOT officials have said they hope that by elevating the stretch of NC-12 onto a bridge, they can eliminate accessibility issues in storms. The bridge is planned to extend from the southern end of the Pea Island National Wildlife Refuge over the Pamlico Sound into Rodanthe, and it was part of a compromise reached with environmental groups when the Bonner Bridge lawsuit was settled. Now, a couple of other articles from this week's Banking, Tech, and Transportation page. Under the heading of Coveted Route comes the article, Frontier Adds Flight to San Diego from RDU. Denver Airline continues to be aggressive at RDU. They're making yet another expansion play at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. This time, it's with a new nonstop flight to San Diego, the California Metro at the top of Raleigh-Durham International Airport's wish list. The flight, which debuts August 15th, is one of a dozen Frontier has announced for RDU in 2018 alone. Michael Walden, economist and professor at NC State University, calls the new flight another indication of continued aggressive expansion by Frontier. He says it's likely based on three factors. Frontier's effort to serve underutilized destinations, the general increase in air travel, and the expected continued growth of the Triangle. Frontier will serve the route with an Airbus 321 aircraft, and tickets are on sale now. While San Diego has long topped RDU's unserved market list in terms of demand, it's increasingly reciprocal. Last year, SAN ranked RDU fourth on its wish list. This year, it's third, according to SAN spokeswoman Rebecca Bloomfield. And with this article is a chart that talks about the how the airlines stack up in terms of in-plane passengers as of the end of April. Delta had a 31.7% share, American 25.8%. Southwest, 19.2%, and United, 12.2%. JetBlue, 4.5%, Frontier, 2.9%. Alaska, 1.7%, Allegiant, 1.3%, and Air Canada, with 0.6%. And finally, completing this week's Banking Tech Transportation page, under the heading of Big Hires comes the article, Two Expanding Companies Tap Women as Site Leads. Two companies, both in the midst of high-profile expansions in the Triangle, have tapped women as site leads in recent days. Infosys and Credit Suisse were two of the biggest headline grabbers in 2017, when they announced expansions worth 2,000 and 1,200 Triangle jobs, respectively. Infosys, the Indian technology services firm, named Devir Learman, former digital commerce leader at IBM, to lead its new innovation hub in Briar Creek in Raleigh. I'm building the strategy, vision, operations, and culture of the newly created innovation hub that will drive enterprise-wide initiatives for our clients locally and across the globe, she writes in her LinkedIn profile. And for Credit Suisse, the Swiss banking giant confirmed the promotion of 17-year Credit Suisse veteran Sophia Wainert, who will be taking over from the retiring Jim Captain. With the new title of Senior Franchise Officer, Wainer will be responsible for driving the strategic properties for the location and strengthening the Credit Suisse brand in the region. Now we turn the page to the Life Sciences page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Stronger Backing comes the article, Alchemy Plans Further Growth After Being Acquired. For contract development and manufacturing organization Alchemy, which recently expanded and moved its headquarters from Wilmington to Durham, its acquisition by a private equity firm paves the way for continued organic growth, as well as a possibility of growth through acquisitions. We now have a partner in place that's really excited to work with us and grow us, and that has the necessary capital and financial strength to support our growth strategies, CEO Stephen Kutzer says. Madison Dearborn Partners of Chicago has agreed to acquire a majority stake in Alchemy from existing shareholder Ares Capital Corporation for an undisclosed amount. The deal is slated to close in the third quarter. Ares completed its acquisition of Alchemy's prior owner, American Capital, in a deal valued at $3.4 billion at the beginning of last year. The potential divestiture of Alchemy by Ares was on the radar since January of 2017, says Kutzer, and related to a focus on core competencies on the financial side. As part of the deal with MDP, Ares is acting as lead debt financing arranger, according to Alchemy, and is maintaining a minority equity position in the CDMO as well. We're very happy to stay independent with strong financial backing, says Kutzer, allowing for continued focus on its small to mid-sized pharmaceutical company client base. MDP also has an expertise in the healthcare space. The leadership team at Alchemy will remain unchanged. Later this year, Alchemy expects to add sterile capacity to its locations in Durham and in Charleston, South Carolina, says Kutzer, and planned expansion in the CDMO's biologics business may be supported through an acquisition in the foreseeable future. We are continuing to hire, said Kutzer. We're off to a record start in the first half of 2018. Alchemy is anticipating to grow sales this year to upward of the $250 million mark. Of Alchemy's recent relocation of its headquarters expansion from Wilmington to the Triangle, Kutzer says, it was definitely part of the overall strategy to get more visibility, to have more exposure to not only clients, but also potential investors. Additionally, more access to talent and to Raleigh-Durham International Airport were among the factors contributing to the move. Now, in other news from the Life Sciences page, under the heading of Helping Eastern North Carolina, comes the article, ECU Plans New School Focused on Rural Health. For Eastern Carolina University, a planned School of Rural Public Health, slated to open in August of 2020, will aid in addressable health disparities faced by people living in the eastern part of the state. It is our mission to work collectively to provide and to train the next generation of public health workforce, with a primary focus here in eastern North Carolina, says Ronnie Bell, professor and chair of the Brody School of Medicine's Department of Public Health at ECU. There have been discussions going on here at ECU since the late 90s about the public health needs of people here in eastern North Carolina, Bell says. About 10 years ago, the ECU Department of Public Health was created, but with the intention that the School of Public Health would be created in the future. The School of Rural Public Health will initially combine existing ECU departments, public health, health education and promotion, biostatistics, health services and information management, and the Center for Health Disparities. When the four departments come together, we will have about 75 to 80 faculty already here or in the process of being recruited, Bell says. Because creating the new school involves bringing existing resources allocated to departments, he says there's not expected to be a significant financial impact. And under the heading of Deal with LSU comes the article, Transenterics Boosted by FDA Nod and Its Second U.S. Sale. Buoyed by a new $40 million loan agreement and expanded U.S. Food and Drug Administration clearance, surgical robot maker Transenterics has sold its second Senhance surgical system in the U.S. to Louisiana State University Health. Senhance received its original clearance from the FDA in October, with a first U.S. sale to Florida Hospital announced in November. The surgical system was previously cleared for use in the U.S. for two types of laparoscopic surgeries, colorectal and gynecologic, or about 1.5 million potentially addressable procedures annually. The most recent clearance expands the potential uses of Senhance to certain laparoscopic hernia and gallbladder removal surgeries, boosting potentially addressable procedures to more than 3 million annually. We're focused on executing on our plan to grow our commercial capabilities, expand our indications, and add to our product portfolio. We've made important recent progress on all these fronts, says Todd Pope, President and CEO of Transenterix. And rounding out today's Life Sciences page, under the heading of More Beds, comes the article, Veritas Growth Continues with New Atlanta Facility. Durham's Veritas Collaborative is continuing its growth spree, prepping to meet more demand. Veritas, a healthcare system for the treatment of eating disorders, opened a new 50-bed hospital in Atlanta on June 4th to provide care to children, adolescents, and young adults who are younger than 21. The roughly 63,000-square-foot facility is located at 41 Perimeter Center East and joins an existing Veritas outpatient facility at 6600 Peachtree Dunwoody Road in Atlanta. We've been working on this opening in Atlanta since 2014, when we started receiving a lot of requests from medical providers, different constituents, and therapists and dietitians in Atlanta, who are convinced of the value of our facility at higher levels of care, says Stacy McIntyre, founder, president, and CEO of Veritas. Veritas has had about 50 patients per year that have traveled from Georgia to North Carolina to seek treatment, she says. Now we turn to this week's real estate page. Under the heading of New Leader comes the article, CEO of Triangle's Oldest Construction Firm Resigns. After more than two decades at McDonnell York Building Company, CEO Heather Denny is leaving the company. She joined shortly after college. Denny is joining Wells Global, a design-build developer based in Raleigh that specializes in critical power systems. It's bittersweet, Denny says of her departure. It's a part of me. I grew up there. McDonnell York is promoting Tanner Holland, who had served as president and joined the firm in 2010 as a senior project manager. He was promoted from chief operating officer last year. Tanner is recognized by his coworkers, our clients, and the community for his exceptional leadership and vision, and we are looking forward to McDonnell York's next chapter under his direction, said Smeed York, chairman of the McDonnell York board. And under the heading of Leasing Back comes the article, Sears sells off Northgate Mall building for $6.5 million. Sears has sold off yet another asset in the Triangle, parting ways with its Northgate Mall building in Durham for $6.5 million. A lease with the new owner, Northwood Investors of Denver, means the retail giant isn't departing the mall, at least not in the immediate future, according to county records. But the sale does come amid a gloomy stretch for the company, which posted a 31% decrease in quarterly revenue recently. Along with a poor financial showing came an announcement that Sears would be closing 48 locations by early September, in addition to 15 Kmarts. The list didn't name any locations in North Carolina, including the four stores in Raleigh and Durham. The Northgate sale is part of a broader move by the company to shed assets. Outside of simply closing stores, the company has been trying to sell some of its properties in leaseback deals. And under the heading of Scrapped comes Walmart cancels plans for two Raleigh stores. Walmart has scrapped plans to bring two of its neighborhood grocery-style stores to Raleigh. The retail giant has bought a property at Poole and New Hope Roads in East Raleigh from a developer and is now trying to sell the 17-acre parcel. To the north on Buffalo Road, the company has abandoned plans with the same developer, WRS Incorporated Real Estate Investments, to build another grocery store on a 6-acre property. The decision to pull out comes amid a broader shift in the company's strategy toward increasing its e-commerce business and driving same-store sales. Last year, Walmart officials said they anticipate a slowdown in new store development, according to Supermarket News, a trade publication. Company officials didn't return calls and emails for comment. WRS still owns the Buffalo Road property and is planning to build another grocery store on the site, Chief Operating Officer Steve Howe says. He plans to announce a new anchor tenant in the coming weeks. A new Lidl is being built just across the street, although Howe says he isn't too concerned about the competition. The German grocer, which typically has a bare-bones interior and low prices, bought a 6-acre property on the other side of the intersection in April for a 35,952 square foot store. They're a pretty unique offering, Hal says. I don't think it will affect what we are trying to do. WRS, based in Charleston, South Carolina, was set to build the Poole Road Walmart as well, but hadn't begun construction before striking a deal with Walmart to sell the property. As recently as May of 2017, Walmart was touting its plans to open the store by the end of that year. And under the heading of New Research comes the article, Report, Affordable Housing Doesn't Impact Home Prices. Residents of the Scottish Hills neighborhood in Kerry had no shortage of objections to a Habitat for Humanity project in their backyard at a Planning and Zoning Board meeting last year. Concerns about the impact of affordable housing on existing neighborhoods are often underpinned by fears about how new development might drag down property values. But Stacy Anfinson, an appraiser with Birch Appraisal, who quantifies real estate trends, says it's important to convey that these conversations have really just been about people's emotions. In the wake of the pushback to the Habitat project in Kerry, the Raleigh Regional Association of Realtors commissioned Anfinson to calculate exactly how Habitat housing might be impacting home prices in Wake County. His report, released in late May, shows that neighbors' concerns might be overblown. Anfinson examined home prices in the 27610 zip code, which covers much of southeast Raleigh, looking at change in median home price, average days on market, and a variety of other metrics. Anfinson focused on that area because it has had many Habitat homes. He found that there's no substantial difference in pricing between neighborhoods with Habitat for Humanity housing versus those without. Because the report only covered a small portion of Raleigh, Anfinson describes the study as a starting point for further research, but he believes the findings would likely hold true elsewhere. And completing the real estate page of this week's Triangle Business Journal comes the article, IKEA Still Wants a Triangle Store. IKEA has abandoned its plans for a 359,000-square-foot store at Kerry Town Center, but that doesn't mean the company has lost all interest in the fast-growing Triangle region. IKEA real estate manager Bob Grimsley says the furniture company would still like to open a store in the area, although he didn't say whether the company has a timeline or specific location in mind. While we do not currently have any immediate plans for a Triangle area store, IKEA has a strong base of customers there, and we look forward to the time when we will open our first Triangle area location, Grimsley wrote in an email. IKEA says its decision to scrap the Kerry store is related to the company's larger strategic shift away from big box stores in suburban areas towards smaller urban stores and online sales. After the Kerry announcement, the Swedish company withdrew plans for stores in Nashville, Tennessee, and Glendale, Arizona. But despite the pullback nationally, IKEA could find another location in the Triangle, perhaps for one of its new, smaller store models. IKEA has opened 24 small-scale stores since 2015, including a new outlet in London that totals just 9,700 square feet, Bloomberg reported earlier this year. The store has no meatballs, and customers can't leave with what they purchase. Instead, the store has a few model rooms. Shoppers use a touchscreen computer to order and schedule delivery. IKEA's departure from Kerry leaves a much larger gaping hole in the plans for Kerry Town Center. The furniture giant was viewed as a key component of the mall's revitalization, which has struggled to attract shoppers and retailers in recent years. Mall owner CBL & Associates says it still plans to redevelop that portion of the mall with a mix of uses including retail, apartments, restaurants, and offices. Now we turn to this week's cover story, the title of which is For Cree, Game On or Lights Out. 9 months in, newcomer Greg Lowe wants to turn Durham's homegrown Cree Incorporated on its head. Lowe's a man of bold promises and big bets, and his biggest gamble yet could be at Cree, where he has staked thousands of jobs and millions of dollars in revenue on Cree's tiniest business unit, Wolfspeed, the firm's Research Triangle Park-based power and radio frequency business. A year and a half ago, Wolfspeed, then awaiting a buyout that never happened, was listed as discontinued operations on Cree's balance sheet. Today, Lowe says, it's scaling up to displace LED lighting as Cree's largest business unit and on track for roughly quadrupling in revenue by 2022. Most people who work in companies that are struggling are actually ready for change, he says. Leadership needs to be engaged and committed, he explains. So once the direction is set, leadership is about helping employees by getting roadblocks out of their way so they can accomplish great things. The opportunity is huge for Wolfspeed, which closed the last fiscal year at $221.2 million. That was 15% of Cree's revenue. In the electric vehicle market alone, where Wolfspeed's signature silicon carbide promises to make batteries last longer than ever, more than $60 billion in investments have been announced by firms such as Volvo, Toyota, and Ford. The Cree Board of Directors admits going all in on Wolfspeed is not the trajectory they first predicted when Lowe replaced CEO Chuck Swoboda in late 2017. But they're betting that Lowe, after more than 30 years at just two companies, can take a complex technology and make it mainstream. They hope he can re-engage a workforce in a slump. And their faith has precedence. After all, Lowe's done it before. In 2012, Austin, Texas-based technology powerhouse Freescale needed a hero. Lowe, in his 27th year at Texas Instruments, needed an opportunity. Some had thought Lowe would take over for CEO Rich Templeton at Texas Instruments, where Lowe had been running the analog division. Lowe, according to Will Strauss, a research analyst at Forward Concepts, had already secured a reputation as a mover within that group. At one time, Texas Instruments was known as a DSP company that also did analog, Strauss explains, referring to specialized microprocessors known as digital signal processors. Now it's a company that does analog and also does DSP. He credits much of that to Lowe's execution-focused approach, characterizing it as meat and potatoes leadership. Lowe leads by stating his position clearly and repeating it to get his point across. He's very good at executing, and that is his strength, Strauss says. It's an attitude board members at Cree would later say they could see during the interview process. He's a beautiful blend of IQ and EQ, Cree board member John Replogle says. This is a guy who, as bright as he is also highly emotionally intelligent. When Texas Instruments Templeton stayed in his role, Lowe and competitor Freescale took a chance on each other. Freescale had started as a division of Motorola in the 1940s, developing the world's first commercial high-power transistor for car radios in 1955 and became independent through a divestment in 2004. But financial difficulties followed. When private equity firm Blackstone bought out Freescale in 2006, it had a $17.6 billion valuation. Within 5 years, it had sunk to $4.6 billion. They were flirting with bankruptcy, says Stacy Razgon, managing director and senior analyst at AB Bernstein. Lowe says when he arrived in 2012, morale was abysmal. Executives worked apart from their underlings in large office suites. He said, given the size of the company revenue-wise, we don't deserve to have these big, lavish offices. I think he changed his first, recalls Robert O'Shana, Freescale's former director of engineering. The office walls fell, and Lowe's reputation rose. O'Shana says Lowe even ate in the cafeteria with employees. Michael Griffith, executive director of Breakthrough Central Texas, one of the largest recipients of Greg and Diana Lowe's philanthropy in Austin, recalls meeting Lowe in the Freescale lobby. He walked us through the hallways, and people were saying hi to him. He was saying hi back, stopping to make a couple of jokes. Really warm from the beginning, Griffith recalls. While Lowe's Freescale predecessor had kept his residence in Silicon Valley, Lowe put his Dallas home on the market, announcing a full move to Freescale's hometown of Austin, an announcement greeted with cheers in an employee town hall, introducing him as CEO, colleagues recall. But not everything was a pep rally, with tens of millions of dollars in employee severance charges as Freescale shifted its focus. Basically, he says, we're spreading the peanut butter too thin, O'Shana says. We're trying to do everything. We're not investing to win in everything. Those units that couldn't make a winning case were pushed to the side. Some people were affected, and it was hard. But for the most part, there was clarity, O'Shana recalls. He explained what he was doing, why he was doing it. He did what he said he would do. It culminated in a $12 billion buyout by Dutch chip maker NXP Semiconductors, a best outcome, Strauss says. But can he do it again? When the CEO opportunity came up at Cree, the company like Freescale 6 years ago was scattered, Lowe recalls. I didn't have a preordained answer, but I did have a methodology, Lowe says. The board wanted, and got, its first outsider in Lowe. Swoboda had been promoted from within. His predecessor, Neil Hunter, co-founded the company in 1987 out of NC State University. Prior to Lowe, the company had planned to pivot into a focused lighting company. Cree, having split attention between lighting, LED components, and its legacy semiconductor business for years, had decided in 2015 to go all in with efficient lighting. Swoboda saw past saving companies and consumers billions on energy costs with LEDs. He foresaw an industry shift toward smart lighting in an Internet of Things world. He imagined streetlights with Wi-Fi hotspots, office buildings where lights adjust automatically, and Cree at the center of it all. Initially, the plan was for the power device and radio frequency division, soon known as Wolfspeed, would be spun out into a standalone company that was intended to go public. That way, Cree's lighting unit would be free to invest in technology that could accelerate the IoT trajectory Swoboda envisioned. Everyone knew Wolfspeed was a great business and had value, had higher margin potential, says Angelo Zeno, who follows the semiconductor industry for CFRA research. But it's one of those businesses that historically had taken a back seat relative to what their focus was on in LEDs and lighting. When German semiconductor Infineon made its $850 million offer for Wolfspeed, Swoboda said the proceeds would accelerate that pivot, allowing it to invest in innovations that help the industry get where it's going. But federal pushback on a deal with a foreign company had Cree and Infineon abruptly canceling the transaction in February of 2017. Wolfspeed, which had been listed as discontinued operations on the balance sheet for months, was back in the Cree fold. But the company didn't know what to do with the division. The stock plummeted as investors and analysts scrambled to comprehend what would happen next, and Swoboda announced his resignation in May of 2017, citing health reasons. The board began its CEO search with no idea of the pivot their new leader would take, Plogle says. We hired Greg not because he's a one-trick pony, but rather because he's a very experienced, strategically intuitive, broad thinker, Plogle says. Greg didn't come in with a set answer, nor did the board hire him for a single solution. We wanted him to really come in and do an objective strategic review and set the course. Now the board is supportive of the course Lowe has chosen, Replogles adds. He's the kind of guy who's easy to follow, he explains. His pace is truly astounding. I'm so delighted with the pace at which he's moving. In his first 100 days, he's put a huge signature all over Cree, in terms of where he's going to take it from a leadership and culture perspective. Lowe says it hadn't been easy. He arrived to what he characterizes as a strong foundation, but one marred by execution issues, a disengaged workforce, and no real direction. So, as he did with Freescale, he initiated that bold review. Every department would be scrutinized, every leader challenged. Customers were questioned. An email was sent out encouraging all employees from the manufacturing line to the C-suite to be candid about what was needed to succeed and what was working against them. The Wolfspeed opportunity emerged from those emails, analyses, and conversations, Lowe says. And while there are no lavish corporate suites to knock over, he's made similar culture plays to what he did at Freescale, putting the corporate jet up for sale. A corporate jet's a symbol of some people get to use it and some people don't get to use it, Lowe says. He shifted some contractor employees to full-time positions, noting temporary contracts don't give you a sense of we're all in this together. He's instituted raises within the manufacturing operation and pushed for more internal promotions. He's aligned the cafeteria's hours on Silicon Drive to allow the night shift to grab a quick breakfast before they leave the campus. One of our shifts got off at 6 in the morning, and our cafeteria opened at 7, he explains. He dons the bunny suit and walks laps around the manufacturing plants to hear opinions from front lines. Oshana isn't surprised. Sounds like he's doing again, he says, predicting success for Cree. Replogle says Lowe has the support of his board, which has given him a long leash to institute change. And Zeno points to rising share prices as symbolic of investor trust in Lowe's direction. But Cree isn't just a balance sheet. It's also thousands of employees, many with decades of dedication to the 30-year-old homegrown Triangle firm. And while, under Lowe, the factories in Durham are expanding, not everyone in the company will be a part of Cree's future. As Wolfspeed grows, tough choices are being made in Cree's two other divisions, LEDs and lighting. In LEDs, Cree is narrowing its focus to what Lowe calls stickier markets, such as automotive lighting. And it's reorganized, putting overlapping portions of that business under Wolfspeed's jurisdiction. For lighting, which had been its largest business unit for years, even more change could be coming, as Lowe's stated goal is to fix the fundamentals. According to Lowe, lighting, at 48% of the firm's fiscal 2017 revenue, grew faster than its infrastructure, creating quality and reliability issues that impacted numbers and reputation. To right the ship, Lowe put a pause on product development, opening a new reliability lab in Durham to help improve the fundamentals. The goal now was to have fiscal 2022 be equal to fiscal 2017 for that unit. We're not going after Herculean objectives, he said. It's simply fixing the business. In lighting, it's also pulling back its Asian business and reallocating some investments in the California Advanced Research Division. By shifting some of its resources out of LEDs and lighting, it can aim more investments at Wolfspeed, he says. But jobs will be impacted. The company expects to incur about $7 million in restructuring charges this year. Following the restructuring of the lighting division, Cree has said it will realize $15 million in annual operating expense reductions. So, it's no surprise that undercurrents of apprehension linger from legacy Cree employees working in the company's lighting unit, those who think that business still has plenty of legs. Add in the long-term Cree observers who snickered when Lowe bought a $6.4 million house in Chatham County with loss gap backing from Cree, and you have a group watching Lowe's every move warily. That does little to deter Lowe from making big moves, however. Lowe won't say whether he, like his predecessor, is considering another big move, such as selling off lighting altogether, to accelerate Cree's trajectory. For now, it's all about fixing the business, he says, not chasing deals. But Zeno says he wouldn't be surprised to see a buyout announcement. I think all options are on the table when it comes to this management team, Zeno says. In the meantime, Lowe is pledging transparency, something he says he's been trying to make part of the culture since day one. It does take some time for this to permeate an organization, and the path forward is not always a straight line, he says, of change. But over a period of time, the organization becomes more engaged, more inspired, and more effective at driving results. While there are other factors that create speed bumps for Lowe's reign, such as trade policy, the U.S. and China are the two biggest economic engines in the world. They're going to have to figure out a way to have a good trade agreement, he predicts. And the U.S.'s punitive sanctions on ZTE, one of Cree's largest radio frequency customers, they're not what worries Lowe about Cree's long-term future. The STEM, that is, science, technology, engineering, and math gap, an anticipated time where job openings exceed the talent qualified to fill them, is real, he says. And offsetting that gap is one of the reasons he's instituted Cree's first internship program. Education is an issue that's driven much of his philanthropic work in Texas, something Griffith predicts he'll repeat in North Carolina. Greg is passionate about supporting first-generation college students, and he talks eloquently about how education changed his life and his own experiences. Griffith says, noting that Lowe and his wife Diana funded two scholarships at two different universities during their time in Texas. But philanthropy may come after execution. For Lowe to have staying power, he's going to have to execute, says Zeno, and the opportunity is huge. Cree practically invented silicon carbide, a material that's exponentially more efficient than the silicon that's been traditionally used in semiconductors for decades, Lowe says. Researchers hope the material makes electric cars go farther, charge faster, and perform better. They imagine charging an entire electric vehicle during a 5-minute bathroom break, or even driving across the country without having to recharge. And that's just one application. Smart grids, power systems, even the NASA Space Fence Project, all involve the complex technology Cree is pumping out through Wolfspeed. And Lowe says the cost and complexity of the equipment and processes involved in manufacturing silicon carbide give Cree's existing plants a big leg up. We have know-how about how to build these machines that nobody else has, he says. Every single day, our competitors are after our customers, so you have to walk faster than your competitors. So what we're doing is we're taking our position we have today and we're solidifying it, running fast. At the same time, adoption of the technology is increasing, says Victor Veliadis, Chief Technology Officer for Power America, an NC State initiative focused on accelerating silicon carbide's position, both for environmental and economic reasons. Up until now, cost has been the biggest barrier in the tech's adoption, pushing many firms to keep using the silicon they've been counting on for decades. If you want to reduce the cost of devices, you've got to streamline manufacturing and have volume, Veliadis says. If you don't have the volume, prices will never come down to the level where they're going to be competitive with silicon. Thanks in part to Power America and its partners, including Cree, volumes have been increasing and costs are on the decline. As a result, the demand is even higher than what is being produced, particularly as electric vehicles grow in popularity, Lowe says. An electric car will go substantially further with the same amount of batteries, Lowe explains, noting the devices used with silicon carbide are lighter and smaller. This is a big deal. So Lowe's first big move was to bet Cree's future on the technology too, taking a gamble that Cree will be able to grow its already dominant position before competitors master the process. Zeno says it's good, albeit surprising. Zeno says it's a good, albeit surprising, call, characterizing Cree as unmatched in its position at the top of that market. But Veliadis says the competition, too, is paying attention to the opportunity. While he predicts a 20-year run before another technology is developed enough to compete with silicon carbide, other players are accelerating their own efforts. In addition to Western semiconductor firms, such as Infineon, several players are emerging with their own silicon carbide device labs in Asia, companies such as Hitachi Mitsubishi. Large manufacturing firms, such as GE, are developing silicon carbide internally. Add in good designers, forming new companies, and Cree could be primed for a battle on multiple fronts. The advantage Cree has is making their own material, processing their own material, and putting it in their own modules. It's vertically integrated, Veliadis says. Lowe says Cree is a big part of the demand that's building. The challenge is getting the cost of silicon carbide down, and we've been able to do that, he says. You're seeing the adoption rate of electric vehicles rise because we've been able to get the cost down. So under Lowe, the company has already started investing, recently purchasing Infineon's entire radio frequency business to take advantage of the 5G transition. When you look at the overall RF space in general, as we migrate from 4G to 5G, I think that's going to be one of the highest growth areas of the market, Zeno says. Predicting Cree's position could put it in line to take advantage of what's coming. It's a place where you absolutely want to be. The competition in any market within the semiconductor industry is going to be competitive, but at the end of the day, this is a great place to be. And Lowe expects to have an engaged workforce to drive what's next. We were clear with the employees when we announced our intentions, he says. People like to see a vision, and they like to know where we are going. I think people know where we are going now. This week's executive voice features Alex Sapir, who is at Dova Pharmaceuticals. Now, a little word about background about Dova Pharmaceuticals. For Dova Pharmaceuticals, helmed by Alex Sapir, the last year and a half has been extremely busy. Less than a year out from its roughly $80 million initial public offering, Dova is preparing to launch its first drug, Doptelet. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the drug, previously known as Avatrombopag, on May 21st. The drug is approved to treat low platelet count in patients with chronic liver disease. Dova says there are about 70,000 patients with CLD suffering from severe low platelet count in the U.S., and the drug is an alternative to more invasive platelet transfusions that can lead to infection and have other risks. Platelet count needs to be increased in patients ahead of such medical procedures as liver biopsies and colonoscopies. In the second half of this year, the company expects to file a supplemental new drug application with the FDA to expand its drug treatment. It's been a whirlwind for Sapir, who got a call about Dova in November of 2016, joined the company 2 months later. But he calls his time with Dova the most exhilarating and rewarding of his professional career. Given its commercial and further development plans, Dova recently committed to an expansion of its space in Durham and may expand its sales staff later this year. So here's the Q&A portion of Executive Voice. Why did you decide to join Dova at the beginning of last year? For me, it was the opportunity to be part of the team that would launch a product that had the chance to truly revolutionize the way in which platelets are given to patients with chronic liver disease who experience thrombocytopenia, that's low platelets. Dova completed its IPO last summer and a secondary offering earlier this year. To what do you attribute the company's recent financing success? Anytime a company has a product that's better than the current standard, the market will reward that. Look at how Southwest Airlines transformed the airline industry, Uber transformed the taxi industry, and Apple transformed the mobile phone industry. The key starts with having a great product. The company's employees are the mere stewards of the great product. So how do you view the potential of Doptelet? We view Doptelet as having the potential to eventually replace the 600,000 platelet transfusions that are given every year in the U.S. in non-emergency situations. We will launch our product in June with a focus on patients with chronic liver disease who experience low platelets and expand beyond that initial market to patients who also experience thrombocytopenia after receiving chemotherapy, assuming those clinical trials are successful. The company's been growing its headcount ahead of its planned commercialization of Doptelet. Has your staffing changed recently? We started 2017 with one employee. We now have over 120. Most of that growth has been the result of hiring our own sales team as we gear up for the launch of Doptelet. Well, what's been the most challenging aspect of your leadership of the company thus far? To ensure that we maintain our collaborative, humble, entrepreneurial, customer-focused culture as we continue to grow. So what are the most important areas of strategic focus for Dova throughout the rest of this year? Simple. To have the best possible launch we can so that every chronic liver disease patient that can benefit from Doptelet is afforded that opportunity. So when you have time outside of work, what's your favorite hobby? I really enjoy officiating lacrosse games. I've been doing it now for 4 years and have a long way to go before I'm actually any good at it. Finally, where's the most interesting place you've traveled to recently? Last summer, my mom treated the entire family, 10 of us, to a 2-week African safari. I highly recommend everyone add it to their bucket list. Now we'll read the editor's notebook from this week's TBJ, and it's entitled, "We're All to Blame for the Rail Funding Fiasco." The move by the North Carolina General Assembly to revise the budget language associated with high-cost projects may have stopped the 17.7-mile, $2.4 billion Chapel Hill to Durham Light Rail project in its tracks. Nestled in the $24 billion budget is a clause that makes expensive projects ineligible for state funding unless the project secures non-state financial support first. The Federal Transit Administration has made it clear that rail and transit agencies must secure 50% of the project costs and matching funds from non-federal and other agencies before the FTA reviews covering the rest. For North Carolina's portion, we're talking about roughly $200 million. So what happens to light rail now? We know when Amazon visited the Triangle, the company inquired about it, and economic development leaders talked about the Durham Orange Line and how the community is all in for light rail in the Triangle. They cited how local county voters approved a half-cent sales tax a few years ago to support transit projects. Go Triangle Project's light rail construction will start by 2020, and the agency estimates more than 20,000 jobs will be created as part of the multiplier effect of this infrastructure improvement. So why did state lawmakers set aside the funding mechanism? Could it be because the Triangle stakeholders did not do a good enough job explaining the ripple effects of economic development in metropolitan areas? And whose fault is that? It's easy to blame the sentiment in the General Assembly and opine that lawmakers representing the rural and non-metro areas are not interested in helping pay for things in Raleigh, Durham, and Charlotte. That's unknown. But what are we doing to educate and explain to those lawmakers the economic curve and the residual benefits of supply and demand? Not very much, it looks like. I think we've maybe gotten too busy patting ourselves on the backs about our accomplishments and believing things are on the right track because Apple and Amazon are seriously looking at us. I would argue it is not, and the light rail funding fiasco is a prime example. Even if we secure Amazon or Apple, or both, the need for light rail does not go away. In fact, it gets even more critical to fund the project. A lobbyist on Jones Street argued the Triangle did not do a good job of selling the project to the legislature. Now comes the time to find an alternate source, just like what the Metropolitan Council in Minnesota did when state lawmakers refused to authorize $145 million for the Southwest LRT project. With the backing of Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton, the council went around the lawmakers and got capital commitments from other non-state agencies. The workaround made the legislature mad, but it was acceptable to the federal agency funding a good portion of the project. So who will lead the Triangle to move the ball past the finish line? Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.